Chapter 25. Attending Elida. Gold-embossed leather folder under her arm, Tarna kept to the central core of the tower as she climbed toward Elida's apartments, although it meant using a seemingly endless series of staircases. Twice those stairs were not located where she remembered them, but so long as she continued upward, she would reach her destination, rather than the gently spiraling corridors. On the stairs, she met no one but the occasional liveried servants, who bowed or curtsied before hurrying on about their tasks. In either of the spiraling hallways, she would have to pass the entrances to the Aja quarters, and perhaps encounter other sisters. Her keeper's stole allowed her to enter any Aja's quarters, yet she avoided all except the red, save when duty called. Among sisters of the other Ajas, she was all too aware that her narrow stole was red, all too aware of hot eyes watching her from cold faces. They did not unnerve her. Little did. She took the shifting interior of the tower in stride. But still, she thought matters had not gone so far that anyone would actually attack the keeper. Yet she took no chances. Retrieving the situation was going to be a long, hard struggle, whatever Elida thought, and an assault on the keeper might make it irretrievable. Besides, not having to watch over her shoulder allowed her to think on Pavara's troubling question, one she had not considered before suggesting the bonding of Ashaman. Who in the red actually could be trusted with the task? Hunting men who could channel led red sisters to look askance at all men, and a fair number hated them. A surviving brother or father might well escape hatred, a favorite cousin or uncle, but once they were all gone, so was affection and trust. And there was another matter of trust. Bonding any man violated custom strong as law. Even with Tsutama's blessings, who might run to Elida when bonding Ashaman was broached? She had removed three more names from her mental list of possibilities by the time she reached the entrance to Elida's apartments, only two floors below the top of the tower. After almost 2 weeks, her list of those she could be certain of still contained only a single name, and that one was impossible for the task. Elida was in her sitting room, where the furnishings were all gilt and ivory inlays, and the large patterned carpet was one of Tyr's finest creations. She was sitting in a low-backed chair before the marble fireplace, sipping wine with Meidani. Seeing the gray was no surprise, despite the early hour. Meidani dined with the Amarlin most nights, and visited often during the day by invitation. Elida, her six-striped stole wide enough to cover her shoulders, was regarding the taller woman over her crystal goblet, a dark-eyed eagle regarding a mouse with big blue eyes. Meidani, emeralds at her ears and on a wide collar around her slim throat, seemed very conscious of that gaze. Her full lips smiled, but they seemed tremulous. The hand not holding her goblet moved constantly, touching the emerald comb over her left ear, patting her hair, covering her bosom, which was largely exposed by her snug bodice of brocaded silvery-gray silk. Her bosom was hardly excessive, yet her slenderness made it seem so, and she appeared about to pop free of the garment. The woman was garbed for a ball, or a seduction. "The morning reports are ready, Mother," Tarna said, bowing slightly. Light? She felt as if she had intruded on lovers. "You won't mind leaving us, Meidani?" Even the smile Elida directed at the yellow-haired woman was predatory. "Of course not, Mother." Meidani set her goblet on the small table beside her chair and leaped to her feet, offering a curtsy that nearly had her out of her dress. "Of course not." She scurried from the room, breathing hard, her eyes wide. When the door closed behind her, Elida laughed. "We were pillow friends as novices," she said, rising. "And I believe she wants to renew the relationship. I may let her. She might reveal more on the pillows than she's let slip so far. Which is nothing, truth to tell." She strode to the nearest window and stood staring down toward where her fantastical palace would rise to overtop the tower itself. Eventually. If sisters could be convinced to work on it again. The heavy rain that had begun during the night was still falling, and it seemed unlikely she could see anything of that palace's foundations, all that had been completed so far. "Help yourself to wine if you wish." Tarna kept her face smooth with an effort. Pillow friends were common among novices and accepted, but girlhood things should be left behind with girlhood. Not all sisters saw it so, certainly. Galena had been quite surprised when Tarna refused her advances after gaining the shawl. She herself found men far more attractive than women. Most seemed heavily intimidated by Aes Sedai, to be sure, especially if they learned you were Red Aja. But over the years she had come across a few who were not. "That seems odd, Mother," she said, putting the leather folder down on the side table that held an ornately wrought golden tray bearing a crystal wine pitcher and goblets. "She appears frightened of you." Filling a goblet, she sniffed the wine before sipping. The keepings seemed to be working, for now. Elida had finally agreed that that weave, at least, must be shared. "Almost as if she knew that you know about her being a spy." "Of course she's afraid of me." Sarcasm dripped heavily from Elida's voice, but then hardened to stone. "I want her afraid. I intend to put her through the mangle. By the time I have her birched, she'll tie herself to the birching frame if I order it. If she knew I knew, Tarna, she'd be fleeing instead of delivering herself into my hands." Still staring out into the rainstorm, she sipped at her wine. "Have you any news of the others?"
"No, Mother."
"If I could inform the sitters of why they're to be watched..."
"No!"
Elida snapped, spinning to face her. Her dress was such a mass of intricate red scrollwork that the embroidery all but hid the gray silk beneath. Tarna had suggested that less flaunting of her former Aja, she had phrased it more diplomatically, but that was what she meant, might help bring the Ajas together again. Yet Elida's eruption of fury had been sufficient to keep her quiet on the topic since.
"What if some of the sitters are working with them? I wouldn't put it past them. Those ridiculous talks continue at the bridge despite my orders. No, I wouldn't put it past them at all."
Tarna inclined her head over her goblet, accepting what she could not change. Elida refused to see that if the Ajas disobeyed her order to break off the talks, they were unlikely to spy on their own sisters at her command without knowing why. Saying so would only result in another tirade, though. Elida stared at her as if to make sure she was not going to argue. The woman seemed harder than ever, and more brittle. "A pity the rebellion in Tarabon failed," she said at last. "There's nothing to be done about it, I suppose." But she mentioned it frequently at odd moments, since word came back that the Seanchan were reasserting their grip on that country. She was not so resigned as she pretended.
"I want to hear some good news, Tarna. Is there any word of the seals on the Dark One's prison? We must make sure no more get broken."
As if Tarna did not know that.
"Not that the Ajas have reported, Mother, and I don't think they would hold that back."
She wished she had those last words back as soon as they were spoken. Elida grunted. The Ajas released only trickles of what their eyes and ears told them, and she resented that bitterly. Her own eyes and ears were concentrated in Andor.
"How is the work coming at the harbors?"
"Slowly, Mother." With the flow of trade stifled, the city was already feeling hunger. It would begin starving soon, unless the harbor mouths were cleared. Even cutting away the portion of the North Harbor chain that was still iron had proved not enough to allow sufficient ships in to feed Tarvalen. Once Tarna was able to convince her of the necessity, Elida had ordered the chain towers dismantled so those huge pieces of Quendiar could be removed. Like the city walls, however, the towers had been built and strengthened with the power, and only the power could disassemble them. It was far from easy. The original builders had done good work, and those wards seemed not to have weakened a hair.
"Reds are doing most of the work for the time being. Sisters from other Ajas come now and then, but only a few. I expect that will change soon, though."
They knew the necessity of the work, however much they might resent it. No sister could like having to labor in that fashion. The Reds doing most of it certainly grumbled enough, but the order had come from Elida, and these days that resulted in foot-dragging. Elida breathed heavily, then took a long drink. She seemed to need it. Her hand gripped the goblet so hard that tendons stood out on its back. She advanced across the patterned silk carpet as if she meant to strike at Tarna.
They defy me again. Again! I will have obedience, Tarna. I will have it. Write out an order, and once I sign and seal it, post it in every Aja's quarters.
She stopped almost nose to nose with Tarna, her dark eyes glittering like a raven's eyes.
The sitters of any Aja that fails to send its fair share of sisters to work on the chain towers will take a daily penance from Sylviana until the matter is rectified. Daily! And the sitters of any Aja that sends sisters to those talks will do the same. Write it out for me to sign.
Tarna drew a deep breath.
Penances might work and they might not, depending on how set the sitters were. And the Aja heads... She did not think things had gone so wrong that they might refuse to accept penance at all. That would be an end to Elida for sure, perhaps an end to the tower. But posting the order publicly, not allowing the sitters a scrap to hide behind and maintain their dignity, was the wrong way to go about it. In truth, it might well be the very worst way.
"If I may make a suggestion," she began as delicately as she could manage. She had never been known for delicacy.
"You may not," Elida cut in harshly.
She took another long drink, draining her goblet, and glided across the carpet to refill it. She drank too much of late. Tarna had even seen her drunk once.
"How is Sylviana doing with the Alvear girl?" she said as she poured.
"Egwene spends near enough half of every day in Sylviana's study, mother." She was careful to keep her tone neutral. This was the first time Elida had asked after the young woman since her capture, 9 days ago.
"So much? I want her tamed to the tower's harness, not broken."
"I doubt she will be broken, mother. Sylviana will be careful of that." And then there was the girl herself. That was not for Elida's ears, though. Tarna had been shouted at more than enough. She'd learned to avoid subjects that only resulted in shouting. Advice and suggestions unoffered were no more useless than advice and suggestions untaken, and Elida almost never took either.
"Egwene's stubborn, but I expect she must come around soon."
The girl had to. Galena beating Tarna's block out of her had not expended a tenth of the effort Sylviana was putting into Egwene. The girl had to yield to that soon.
"Excellent," Elida murmured. "Excellent."
She looked over her shoulder, her face a mask of serenity. Her eyes still glittered, though.
"Put her name on the roster to attend me. In fact, have her attend me tonight. She can serve supper for Meidani and me."
"It will be as you command, mother." It seemed yet another visit to the Mistress of Novices was inevitable. But no doubt Egwene would earn just as many of those if she never came near Elida.
"And now your reports, Tarna."
Elida sat down again and crossed her legs. Replacing her barely touched goblet on the tray, Tarna took up her folder and sat in the chair Meidani had been using. "The redone wards appeared to be keeping rats out of the tower, mother. For how long was another question. She checked those wards herself every day. But ravens and crows have been seen in the tower ground, so the wards on the walls must be..."
The midday sun cast dappled light through the leafy branches of the tall trees, mostly oak and leatherleaf and sour gum, with a smattering of cottonwoods and massive pines. Apparently there had been a fierce windstorm some years back, because fallen timber, scattered about here and there but all stretched in the same direction, provided good seating with only a little hatchet work to hack away a few limbs. Sparse undergrowth allowed a good view in all directions, and not far off a small clear stream splashed over mossy stones. It would have been a good campsite if Matt had not been intent on covering as much ground as he could every day, but it did just as well as a place to rest the horses and eat. The Demona Mountains still lay at least 300 miles to the east, and he intended to reach them in a week. Vannon said he knew a smuggler's pass, purely by hearsay, of course, just something he had overheard by chance, but he knew right where to find it. They would have them inside Mirandi 2 days after that. Much safer than trying to go north into Andor or south toward Ilion. In either direction, the distance to safety would be further, and the chance of encountering Shonchan greater. Matt gnawed the last scrap of meat from a rabbit's hind leg and tossed the bone onto the ground. Balding Lopin darted in, stroking at his beard in consternation, to pick it up and drop it in the pit he and Naram had made in the mulch-covered forest floor, though the pit would be dug up by animals within a half hour after their departure. Matt moved to wipe his hands on his breeches. Tuan, nibbling at a grouse leg on the other side of the low fire, gave him a very direct look, her eyebrows raised, while the fingers of her free hand wiggled at Seleucia, who had ravaged half a grouse by herself. The bosomy woman did not reply, but she sniffed, loudly. Meeting Tuan's gaze, he deliberately wiped his hands on his breeches again. He could have gone over to the stream, where the Aes Sedai were washing their hands, but no one's clothing was going to be pristine by the time they reached Mirandi in any case. Besides, when a woman named you Toy all the time, it was natural to take any chance to let her know you were nobody's toy. She shook her head and waggled her fingers again. This time Seleucia laughed, and Matt felt his face heat. He could imagine two or three things she might have said, none of which he would have enjoyed hearing. Setala, sitting on the end of his log, made sure he heard some of them anyway. Reaching an agreement with the one-time Aes Sedai had not shifted her attitudes a hair. "She might have said men are pigs," she murmured without lifting her eyes from her embroidery hoop. "Or just that you are." Her dark gray riding dress had a high neck, but she still wore her snug silver necklace with the marriage knife hanging from it. "She may have said you're a mud-footed country lout with dirt in your ears and hay in your hair. Or she might have said, 'I think I see the direction you're going,'" he told her through gritted teeth. Tuan giggled, though the next instant her face belonged on an executioner once more, cold and stern. Pulling his silver-mounted pipe and goatskin tobacco pouch from his coat pocket, he thumbed the bowl full and lifted the lid on the box of strikers at his feet. It fascinated him the way fire just sprang up, spikes of it darting in all directions at first, when he scratched the lumpy red-and-white head of a striker down the rough side of the box. He waited until the flame burned away from the head before using it to light his pipe. Pulling the taste and smell of sulfur into his mouth once had been enough for him. He dropped the burning stick and ground it firmly under his boot. The mulch was still damp from the last rain to fall here, but he took no chances with fire in woods. In the two rivers, men turned out from miles around when the woods caught fire. Sometimes hundreds of marches burned even so. "The strikers, they should not be wasted," Aludra said, lifting her eyes from the small stones board balanced atop a nearby log. Tom, stroking his long white mustaches, continued to contemplate the cross-hatched board. He rarely lost at stones, yet she had managed to win 2 games from him since they left the show. 2 out of a dozen or more, but Tom took care with anyone who could defeat him even once. She swept her beaded braids back over her shoulders. "Me, I must be in the same place for 2 days to make more. Men always find ways to make work for women, yes?" Matt puffed away, if not contentedly, at least with some degree of pleasure. Women, a delight to look at and a delight to be with, when they were not finding ways to rub salt into a man's hide. It seemed 6 up and a half dozen down. It truly did. Most of the party had finished eating. The best part of 2 grouse and 1 rabbit were all that remained on the spits over the fire, but they would be taken along wrapped in linen. The hunting had been good during the morning's ride, yet there was no certainty the afternoon would be as profitable, and flatbread and beans made a poor meal. Those who were finished were taking their ease, or, in the case of the Red Arms, checking the hobbled pack horses, better than 60 of them on 4 leads. Buying so many in Matarin had been expensive, but Luca had rushed into town to take care of the bargaining himself once he had heard about a merchant dead in the street. He almost, almost, but not quite, had been ready to give them pack horses from the show's animals to be rid of Matt after that. Many of the animals were loaded with Aludra's paraphernalia and her supplies. Luca had ended up with the greater part by far of Matt's gold one way and another. Matt had slipped a fat purse to Petra and Clarine, too, but that was friendship, to help them buy their inn a little sooner. What remained in his saddlebags was more than enough to see them comfortably to Murundi, though, and all he needed to replenish it was a common room where dice were being tossed. Lylwyn, with a curved sword hanging from a broad leather strap that slanted across her chest, and Domin, with a short sword on one side of his belt and a brass-studded cudgel on the other, were chatting with Julin and Amathera on yet another log close by. Lylwyn, he had come to accept that was the only name she would stomach, made a point of showing that she would not avoid Tuan or Seleucia, or lower her eyes when they met, though she had to steel herself visibly to carry it off. Julin had the cuffs of his black coat turned back, a sign he felt among friends, or at least people he could trust. The one-time Panarch of Terabon still clutched the thief-catcher's arm tightly, but she met Lylwyn's sharp blue eyes with little flinching. In fact, she often seemed to gaze at the other woman with something approaching awe. Seated cross-legged on the ground and unmindful of the dampness, Noel was playing snakes and foxes with Ulver and spinning wild tales about the lands beyond the Aiel Waste, about some great coastal city that foreigners were not allowed to leave, except by ship, and the inhabitants were not allowed to leave at all. Matt wished they would find another game to play. Every time they brought out that piece of red cloth with its spiderweb of black lines, it reminded him of his promise to Tom, reminded him the bloody eel fin were inside his head somehow, and maybe the flaming ale fin too. The Aes Sedai came up from the stream, and Jolene stopped to talk with Blerick and Fenn. Bethamon and Sita, trailing along behind, hesitated until a gesture from the green sent them to stand behind the log where Teslin and Edesina sat, as far apart as they could manage, with uncut branches between, and began reading small leather-bound books taken from their belt pouches. Both Bethamon and Sita stood behind Edesina. The yellow-haired former Suldam had come round in spectacular and painful fashion. Painful for her and for the sisters. When she first hesitantly asked them to teach her too, at supper the night before, they refused. They were only teaching Bethamon because she had already channeled. Sita was too old to become a novice. She had not channeled, and that was that. So she duplicated whatever it was that Bethamon had done, and had all three leaping about the cook fire and squealing in showers of dancing sparks for as long as she could hold on to the power. They agreed to teach her then. At least Jolene and Edesina did. Teslin still was having none of any Suldam, former or not. All three of them took a hand in switching her, though, and she had spent the morning continually easing herself in her saddle. She still looked afraid, of the One Power and maybe of the Aes Sedai, but strangely, her face somehow seemed content, too. How to understand that was beyond Matt. He should have felt content himself. He had avoided a charge of murder, avoided riding blindly into a Shaun Chan trap that would have killed Tuan, and left the golem behind for good this time. It would be following Luca's show, and Luca had been warned for whatever good that would do. In well under 2 weeks, he would be over the mountains into Murundi. The need to figure out how to get Tuan back to Ebu Dar safely— no easy task at all now, especially since he would have to guard against Aes Sedai trying to spirit her away, would mean that much longer to look at her face. And to try puzzling out what went on behind those big, beautiful eyes. He should have been as happy as a goat in a corn crib. He was far from it. For one thing, all those sword cuts he had received in Matarin hurt. Some of them were inflamed, though he had managed to keep that from anyone so far. He hated being fussed over nearly as much as he hated anyone using the power on him. Lopin and Nerim had sewed him up as well as they could, and he had refused healing despite attempted bullying by all three Aes Sedai. He had been surprised that Jolene, of all people, tried to insist, but she did, and flung up her hands in disgust when he failed to relent. Another surprise had been Tuon.
"Don't be foolish, Toy," she had drawled in his tent, standing over him, arms folded beneath her breasts, while Lopin and Nerim plied their needles and he gritted his teeth. Her proprietary air, very much a woman making sure her property was repaired properly, had been enough to make him grind his teeth, never mind the needles. Or that he was down to his small clothes. She had just walked in and refused to leave short of manhandling, and he had felt in no condition to manhandle a woman he suspected might be able to break his arm.
"This healing is a wonderful thing. My Mylan knows it, and I taught it to my others, too. Of course, many people are foolish about having the power touch them. Half my servants would faint at the suggestion, and most of the blood, too. I shouldn't be surprised. But I wouldn't have expected it of you."
If she had a quarter his experience of Aes Sedai, she would have. They had ridden off up the road from Matarin, as if setting out for Lugard, then taken to the forest as soon as the last farms were out of sight. The moment they entered the trees, the dice started up in his head again. That was the other thing that soured his mood, those bloody dice drumming inside his head for 2 days. There hardly seemed any way they could stop here in the forest. What kind of momentous event could happen in the woods? Still, he had stayed well clear of small villages they had passed. Sooner or later the dice would stop, though, and he could only wait for it. Tuon and Seleucia headed for the stream to wash, wiggling their fingers at one another rapidly. Talking about him, he was sure. When women started putting their heads together, you could be sure. Amathera screamed, and every head whipped around toward her. Matt spotted the cause as quickly as Julin did. A black-scaled snake, a good 7 feet long, wriggling quickly away from the log Julin was seated on. Lyalwyn cursed and leaped to her feet, drawing her sword, but no faster than Julin, who tugged his short sword free of its scabbard and started after the snake so swiftly that his conical red cap fell off.
"Let it go, Julin," Matt said. "It's heading away from us. Let it go."
The thing probably had a den under that log, and had been surprised to come out and find people. Luckily, black lances were solitary snakes. Julin hesitated before deciding that comforting a shivering Amathera was more important than chasing a snake.
"What kind is it, anyway?" he said, folding her in his arms.
He was a city man, after all, Matt told him, and for a moment he looked as though he meant to go after it again. Wisely, he decided against. Black lances were quick as lightning, and with a short sword he would have needed to get close. Anyway, Amathera was clinging to him so hard, he would have had a time getting free of her. Taking his hat from the butt of his ashandarai, which was driven point down into the ground, Matt settled it on his head.
"Daylight's wasting," he said around his pipe stem. "Time we were moving on. Don't dawdle over there, Tuon. Your hands are clean enough."
He had tried calling her precious, but since her claim of victory back in Matarin, she refused to acknowledge that he had even spoken when he did. She did not hurry in the slightest, of course. By the time she returned, drying her small hands on a small piece of toweling that Seleucia would drape across the pommel of her saddle to dry, Nerim and Lopin had filled in the refuse pit, wrapped the remains of the meal, and tucked them into Nerim's saddlebags, and doused the fire with water brought from the stream in folding leather buckets. Ashandarai in hand, Matt was ready to mount Pips.
"A strange man who lets poisonous serpents go," Tuon said. "From the fellow's reaction, I assume a black lance is poisonous."
"Very," he told her. "But snakes don't bite anything they can't eat unless they're threatened."
He put a foot in the stirrup.
"You may kiss me, Toy."
He gave a start. Her words, not spoken softly, had made them the object of every eye. Seleucia's face was so stiffly expressionless, her disapproval could not have been plainer.
"Now," he said, "when we stop tonight, we could take a stroll alone."
"By tonight, I may have changed my mind, Toy. Call it a whim for a man who lets poisonous snakes go."
Maybe she saw one of her omens in that? Taking off his hat and sticking the black spear back into the ground, he took the pipe from between his teeth and planted a chaste kiss on her full lips. A first kiss was nothing to be rough with. He did not want her to think him pushy or crude. She was no tavern maid to enjoy a bit of slap and tickle. Besides, he could almost feel all those eyes watching. Someone snickered. Seleucia rolled her eyes. Tuan folded her arms beneath her breasts and looked up at him through her long eyelashes.
"Do I remind you of your sister?" she asked in a dangerous tone. "Or perhaps your mother?"
Somebody laughed. More than one somebody, in fact. Grimly, Matt tapped the dottle from his pipe on the heel of his boot and stuffed the warm pipe into his coat pocket. He hung his hat back on the Ashendari. If she wanted a real kiss, had he really thought she would not fill his arms? Slim, she was to be sure, and small, but she filled them very nicely indeed. He bent his head to hers. She was far from the first woman he had kissed. He knew what he was about. Surprisingly, or then again perhaps not so surprisingly, she did not know. She was a quick pupil, though, very quick. When he finally released her, she stood there looking up at him and trying to catch her breath. For that matter, his breath came a little raggedly, too. Metwin whistled appreciatively. Matt smiled. What would she think of what plainly was her first real kiss ever? He tried not to smile too widely, though. He did not want her to think he was smirking. She laid fingers against his cheek.
"I thought so," she said in that slow, honey drawl. "You're feverish. Some of your wounds must be infected."
Matt blinked. He gave her a kiss that had to have curled her toes, and all she said was that his face was hot. He bent his head again. This time she would bloody well need help to stay standing. But she put a hand against his chest, fending him off.
"Seleucia, fetch the box of ointments I got from Mistress Luca," she commanded.
Seleucia went scurrying for Tuon's black and white mount.
"We don't have time for that now," Matt said. "I'll smear on something tonight."
He might as well have kept his mouth shut.
"Strip off, Toy," she said in the same tone she had used with her maid. "The ointment will sting, but I expect you to be brave." "I am not going to—"
"Riders coming,"
Harnan announced. He was already in his saddle, on a dark bay gelding with white forefeet, holding the lead to one of the strings of pack horses.
"One of them's Vannin."
Matt swung up onto Pips for a better vantage. A pair of horsemen were approaching at a gallop, dodging around fallen trees when they had to. Aside from recognizing Chell Vannin's dun, there was no mistaking the man himself. Nobody else who was that wide and sat his saddle like a sack of suet could have maintained his seat at that pace without any apparent effort. The man could have stayed in a saddle on a wild boar. Then Matt recognized the other rider, whose cloak was flailing behind him, and felt as if he had been punched in the belly. He would not have been surprised in the least had the dice stopped then, but they kept bouncing off the inside of his skull. What in the light was Talmanis bloody well doing in Altara? The two riders slowed to a walk short of Matt, and Vannin reined in to let Talmanis approach alone. It was not shyness. There was nothing shy about Vannin. He leaned lazily on the tall pommel of his saddle and spat to one side through a gap in his teeth. No, he knew Matt would not be best pleased, and he meant to stay clear.
"Vannin brought me up to date, Matt," Talmanis said.
Short and wiry, with the front of his head shaved and powdered, the Kyrianan had the right to wear stripes of color across his chest in considerable number, but a small red hand sewn to the breast of his dark coat was its only decoration unless you counted the long red scarf tied around his left arm. He never laughed and seldom smiled, but he had his reasons.
"I was sorry to hear about Nalisian and the others. A good man, Nalisian. They all were."
"Yes, they were," Matt said, keeping a tight rein on his temper.
I assume Egwene never came to you for help getting away from those fool Aes Sedai? But what in the bloody flaming light are you doing here?
Well, maybe he did not have such a tight rein after all.
At least tell me you haven't brought the whole bloody band 300 bloody miles into Altara with you.
Egwene is still the Armorlin, the other man said calmly, straightening his cloak. Another red hand, larger, marked that.
You were wrong about her, Matt. She really is the Armorlin seat. And she has those Aes Sedai by the scruff of the neck, though some of them might not know it yet. The last I saw, she and the whole lot of them were off to besiege Tar Valon. She might have it by now. They can make holes in the air like the one the Dragon Reborn made to take us near Saladar.
The colors spun in Matt's head, resolving for an instant into Rand talking to some woman with gray hair in a bun atop her head. An Aes Sedai, he thought, but his anger blew the image away like mist. All that talk of the Armorlin seat in Tar Valon attracted the sisters, of course. They heeled their horses up beside Matt and tried to take over. Well, Edesina hung back a little the way she did when Teslin or Jolene had the bit in her teeth, but the other two...
"Who do you be talking about?"
Teslin demanded while Jolene was still opening her mouth.
"Egwene. There did be an accepted named Egwene Alvear, but she be a runaway."
"Egwene Alvear is the one, Aes Sedai," Talmanis said politely.
The man was always polite to Aes Sedai.
"And she is no runaway. She is the Armorlin seat, my word on it."
Edesina made a sound that would have been called a squeak coming from anyone but an Aes Sedai.
"Later for that," Matt muttered.
Jolene opened her mouth again, angrily.
"Later, I said."
That was not enough to stop the slender green, but Teslin laid a hand on her arm and murmured something, and that was. Jolene still glared daggers, though, promising to drag out everything she wanted to know later.
"The band, Talmanis?" "Oh. No, I only brought 3 banners of horse and 4,000 mounted crossbowmen. I left 3 banners of horse and 5 of foot, a little short of crossbows, in Murundi, with orders to move north to Andor. And the Mason's banner, of course. Handy to have Masons ready to hand if you need a bridge built or the like."
Matt squeezed his eyes shut for a moment.
6 banners of horse and 5 of foot. And a banner of Masons? The band had only been 2 banners, counting horse and foot, when he left them in Saladar. He wished he had back half the gold he had handed over to Luca so freely.
"How am I supposed to pay that many men?" he demanded.
"I couldn't find enough dice games in a year." "Well, as to that, I made a small deal with King Rodron. Finished with now, and not before time. I think he was about ready to turn on us. I will explain later. But the band's coffers hold a year's pay and more. Besides, sooner or later the Dragon Reborn will give you estates and grand ones. He has raised men to rule nations, so I hear, and you grew up with him."
This time he did not fight the colors as they resolved into Rand and the Aes Sedai. It was an Aes Sedai for sure. A hard woman she looked. If Rand tried to give him any titles, he would stuff them down Rand's bloody throat, is what he would do. Matt Cawthon had no liking for nobles. Well, a few like Talmanis were all right, and Tuon. Never forget Tuon. And he certainly had no bloody desire to become one.
"That's as may be," was all he said, though.
Seleucia cleared her throat loudly. She and Tuon moved their horses up beside Matt, and Tuon was so straight in her mare's saddle, so cool-eyed, cold-faced, and regal, that he expected Seleucia to start proclaiming her titles. She did nothing of the sort. Instead, she shifted on her dun and scowled at him, eyes like blue coals in a fire, then cleared her throat again, very loudly. "Ah."
"Tuon," Matt said, "allow me to present Lord Talmanis de Lavinda of Cairhien. His family is distinguished and ancient, and he has added honors to its name."
The little woman inclined her head, perhaps all of an inch.
"Talmanis, this is Tuon."
So long as she called him Toy, she would get no titles from him. Seleucia glared, eyes hotter than ever, impossible as that seemed. Talmanis blinked in surprise, though, and bowed very low in his saddle. Vannon pulled the sagging brim of his hat lower, half hiding his face. He still avoided looking directly at Matt. So, it seemed the man had already told Talmanis exactly who Tuan was. Growling under his breath, Matt leaned from the saddle to snatch his hat from the spear and pull up the Ashandarai. He clapped the hat on his head. "We were ready to move on, Talmanis. Take us to where your men are waiting, and we'll see if we can have as good luck avoiding Shonchan on the way out of Altara as you had on the way in." "We saw a good many Shonchan," Talmanis said, turning his bay to fall in beside Pips, "though most of the men we saw seemed to be Altaran. They have camps scattered everywhere, it seems. Luckily, we saw none of those flying creatures I have heard tell of. But there is a problem, Matt. There was a landslide. I lost my rear guard and some of the pack horses. The pass is well and truly blocked, Matt. I sent 3 men to try climbing over with the orders sending the band to Andor. One broke his neck and another his leg." Matt stopped Pip short. "I'm guessing this is the same pass Vannon was talking about?" Talmanis nodded, and Vannon, waiting to fall in farther back, said, "Bloody right it was. Passes don't grow on trees, not in mountains like the Damonas." He was no respecter of rank. "Then you'll have to find another one," Matt told him. "I've heard you can find your way blindfolded at midnight. It should be easy for you." Flattery never hurt. Besides, he had heard that about the man. Vannon made a sound like he was swallowing his tongue. "Find another pass," he muttered. "Find another pass, the man says. You don't just go find another pass in new mountains like the Damonas. Why do you think I only knew the one?" He was shaken to admit that much. Before this, he had been adamant that he had only heard of it. "What are you talking about?" Matt demanded, and Vannon explained, at great length for him. "An Aes Sedai explained it to me once. You see, there's old mountains. They was there before the breaking, maybe on the bottom of the sea or the like. They have passes all over, broad and gentle. You can ride into those, and as long as you keep your head in your direction and have enough supplies, sooner or later you come out the other side. And then there's mountains made during the breaking." The fat man turned his head and spat copiously. "Passes in those are narrow, twisty things, and sometimes they aren't really what you'd call passes at all. Ride into one of those and you can wander around till your food runs out trying to find a way to the other side. Loss of that pass is going to hurt a lot of folks who use it for what you might call untaxed goods. And men'll die before they find a new one that gets them all the way through. We go into the Damonas with that pass gone, likely we'll all die too. Them as doesn't turn back in time and hasn't gotten their heads so turned around they can't find a way back." Matt looked around, at Tuan, the Aes Sedai, at Ulver. They were all depending on him to get them to safety. But his safe route out of Altara was not there anymore. "Let's ride," he said. "I have to think." He had to bloody think for all he was worth.
Chapter 26. As if the world were fog. Toys at a fast pace through the forest, but Tuan rode close behind him, with Seleucia at her side, of course, so she could listen in on him and Talmanis. Her own thoughts interfered with eavesdropping, however. So he had grown up with the Dragon Reborn, had he? The Dragon Reborn. And he had denied knowing anything at all of the man. That was one lie of his she had failed to catch, and she was good at catching lies. In Shandar, the undetected lie might be the one that killed you, or sent you to the sail block as property. Had she known of his prevarication, she might have slapped his face, rather than allowing him to kiss her. Now that had been a shock, one she was not sure she had recovered from yet. Seleucia had described being kissed by a man, but the actuality made the other woman's descriptions pale. No, she had to listen. You left Estion in charge? Toy erupted so loudly that a covey of gray doves burst from cover in the thin undergrowth with a mournful whirring sound. The man's a fool!
Not too much of a fool to listen to Daerid, Talmanis replied calmly. He did not seem a man to get overly excited. He kept a careful watch, head swiveling constantly. Every so often he scanned the sky through the thick branches overhead, too. He had only heard of Rakan, yet he watched for them. His words were even crisper and quicker than Toy's, and difficult to follow. These people all spoke so fast.
Carloman and Ryman are not fools, Matt. At least Ryman is only a fool sometimes. But neither will they listen to a commoner, no matter how much more he knows about warfare than they do. Edorian will, but I wanted him with me.
That red hand symbol Talmanis wore was intriguing. More than intriguing, much more. Of an old and distinguished house, was he? But Toy was the one. He remembered Hawkwing's face. That seemed utterly impossible, yet his denial of it had plainly been a lie, as plain as the spots on a leopard. Could the red hand be Toy's sigil? But if so, what about his ring? She'd almost fainted when she first saw that. Well, she had come as close to it as she had since childhood.
That's going to change, Talmanis, Toy growled. I let it go on too long as it is. If Ryman and the others command banners now, that makes them banner generals, and you a lieutenant general. Daerid commands 5 banners, and that makes him a lieutenant general, too. Ryman and the others will obey his orders or they can go home. Come Tarman Gaiden, I'm not going to have my skull split open because they bloody refuse to listen to somebody who doesn't have bloody estates.
Talmanis turned his horse to ride around a patch of briars and everyone followed. The tangled vines seemed to have particularly long thorns and hooked besides.
They will not like it, Matt, but they will not go home either. You know that. Have you any ideas yet how we are to get out of Altara?
I'm thinking on it, Toy muttered. I'm thinking on it.
Those crossbowmen, he exhaled heavily. That wasn't wise, Talmanis. For one thing, they're used to marching on their own feet. Half of them will have all they can do to stay in the saddle if we're moving fast, and we're going to have to. They can be useful in woods like these or anywhere they have plenty of cover, but if we're on open ground with no pikes, they'll be ridden down before they can lose a second flight.
In the distance, a lion coughed.
In the distance. But it was still enough to make the horses whicker nervously and dance a few steps.
Toy leaned forward on his gelding's neck and appeared to whisper in the animal's ear. It quieted immediately. So that had not been another of his fanciful tales after all. Remarkable.
I picked men who could ride, Matt, Talmanis said once his bay stopped frisking. And they all have the new crank.
A touch of excitement entered his voice now. Even restrained men tended to warmth over weapons.
3 turns of the crank.
His hands moved in a quick circle, demonstrating. And the bowstring is latched. With a little training, a man can get off 7 or 8 quarrels in a minute. With a heavy crossbow.
Seleucia made a small sound in her throat. She was right to be startled.
If Talmanis was telling the truth, and he had no reason to lie that Tuon could find, then she had to obtain one of these marvelous cranks somehow. With one for a pattern, artisans could make more. Archers could shoot faster than crossbowmen, but they took longer to train, too. There were always more crossbowmen than archers.
7? Toy exclaimed incredulously.
That would be more than useful, but I never heard of such a thing. Ever. He muttered that as if it had some special significance, then shook his head.
How did you come by it?
7 or 8. There was a mechanic in Murundi who wanted to take a wagonload of things he had invented up to Camelon. There is a school of some sort there for scholars and inventors. He needed money for the journey, and he was willing to teach the band's armorers to make the things. Smother your enemy with arrows at every opportunity. It is always better to kill your enemies far off than close at hand.
Seleucia held her hands up so Tuon could see them, slim fingers moving quickly.
What is this band they speak of?
She used the proper form, inferior to superior, yet her impatience was almost palpable. Impatience with everything that was happening. Tuon kept few secrets from her, but some seemed advisable for the present.
She would not put it past Seleucia to return her to Ebu Dar forcibly, so she would not be breaking her word. A shadow's duties were many, and sometimes required paying the final sacrifice. She did not want to have to order Seleucia's execution. She replied in the imperative form, "Toy's personal army, obviously. Listen, and we may learn more." Toy commanding an army seemed very odd. He was charming at times, even witty and amusing, but often a buffoon and always a rapscallion. He had seemed very much in his element as Tylan's pet. Yet he had seemed in his element among the show's performers, too, and with the Maroth Damani and the two escaped Damani, and in the Hell. That had been such a disappointment. Not even one fight. Events later had not compensated for that. Getting swept up in a street brawl was hardly the same as seeing fights in a hell, which admittedly had been far more boring than rumor heard in Ebu Dar had made it seem. Toy had displayed an unexpected side of himself in that street brawl, a formidable man, though with a peculiar weakness. For some reason she found that strangely endearing.
"Good advice," he said absently, tugging at the black scarf tied around his neck.
She wondered about the scar he took such pains to hide. That he did was understandable. Why had he been hanged, and how had he survived? She could not ask. She did not mind lowering his eyes a little. In fact, it was enjoyable making him writhe. It took so little effort. But she did not want to destroy him. At least, not for the moment.
"Do you not recognize it?" Talmanis said. "It is from your book. King Roedron has two copies in his library. He has it memorized. The man thinks it will make him a great captain. He was so pleased with how our bargain worked out that he had a copy printed and bound for me."
Toy gave the other man a mystified look.
"My book? The one you told us about, Matt. Fog and Steel by Madoc Comadren."
"Oh, that book," Toy shrugged. "I read it a long time ago." Tuon gritted her teeth, her fingers flashed. "When will they stop talking of books and go back to interesting things?" "Perhaps if we listen, we may learn more," Seleucia replied. Tuon glared at her, but the woman wore such an innocent look that she could not maintain her scowl. She laughed, softly, so as not to let Toy realize how close behind him she was, and Seleucia joined in, softly. Toy had fallen silent, though, and Talmanis seemed content to leave it so. They rode in silence, save for the sounds of the forest, birds singing, strange black-tailed squirrels chittering on branches. Tuon set herself to watching for omens, but nothing caught her eye. Bright-feathered birds darted among the trees. Once they spotted a herd of perhaps 50 tall, lean cattle with very long horns that stuck out almost straight to either side. The animals had heard them coming and were squared up, facing them. A bull tossed his head and pawed at the ground. Toy and Talmanis led the careful way around the herd, keeping their distance. She looked over her shoulder. The Red Arms. Why were they called that? She would have to ask Toy. The Red Arms were leading the pack horses, but Gordoran had raised his crossbow and the others had arrows knocked to their bows. So these cattle were dangerous. There were few omens concerning cattle, and she was relieved when the herd dwindled behind them. She had not come all this way to be killed by a cow, or to see Toy killed by one. After a time, Tom and Aludra came up to ride beside her. The woman glanced at her once, then looked straight ahead. The Tarabonner's face, framed by those brightly beaded braids, was always wooden when she looked at her or Seleucia, so clearly she was one of those who refused to accept the return. She was watching Toy, and she looked satisfied, as if something had been confirmed for her, perhaps. Why had Toy brought her along? Surely not for her fireworks. Those were pretty enough, but they could not compare with skylights performed by even a half-trained Damani. Tom Marilyn was much more interesting. Patently, the white-haired old man was an experienced spy. Who had sent him to Ebu Dar? The White Tower seemed the most obvious candidate. He spent little time around the three who called themselves Aes Sedai,
but a well-trained spy would not give himself away in that fashion. His presence troubled her. Until the last Aes Sedai was leashed, the White Tower was something to be wary of. Despite everything, she still had troubling thoughts at times that somehow Toy was part of a White Tower plot. That was impossible, unless some of the Aes Sedai were omniscient, yet the thought sometimes came to her.
"A strange coincidence, wouldn't you say, Master Merlin?" she said. "Encountering part of Toy's army in the middle of an Altaran forest."
He stroked his long mustaches with a knuckle, failing to mask a small smile.
"He's Tavirin, my lady, and you can never tell what will happen around a Tavirin. It's always interesting when you travel with one of those. Matt has a tendency to find what he needs when he needs it. Sometimes before he knows he needs it."
She stared at him, but he seemed serious.
"He's tied to the pattern?"
That was how the word would translate.
"What is that supposed to mean?"
The old man's blue eyes widened in astonishment.
"You don't know? But it said Arthur Hawkwing was the strongest Tavirin anyone had ever seen, perhaps as strong as Randall Thor. I'd have thought you, of all people, would..."
"Well, if you don't, you don't.
Tavirin are people the pattern shapes itself around, people who were spun out by the pattern itself to maintain the proper course of the weaving, perhaps to correct flaws that were creeping in. One of the Aes Sedai could explain better than I." As if she would have conversation with a Marath Damani. Or worse, a runaway Damani.
"Thank you," she told him politely. "I think I've heard enough."
Tavirin. Ridiculous. These people and their endless superstitions. A small brown bird, surely a finch, flew out of a tall oak and circled Widdershins 3 times above Toy's head before flying on. She had found her omen. Stay close to Toy. Not that she had any intention of doing otherwise. She had given her word, playing the game as it had to be played, and she had never broken her word in her life. Little more than an hour after setting out, as a bird warbled ahead, Seleucia pointed out the first sentry, a man with a crossbow up in the thick branches of a spreading oak, cupping a hand to his mouth. Not a bird, then. More bird calls heralded their advance, and soon they were riding through a tidy encampment. There were no tents, but the lances were neatly stacked, the horses picketed on scattered lines among the trees, near to the blankets of the men who would ride them, with a saddle or pack saddle at every animal's head. It would not take long for them to break camp and be on the march. Their fires were small and gave off little smoke. As they rode in, men in dull green breastplates with that red hand on their coat sleeves and red scarves tied to their left arms began rising to their feet. She saw grizzled faces with scars and fresh young faces, all with their eyes on Toy and expressions she could only call eager. A growing murmur of voices rose, rustling through the trees like a breeze.
"It's Lord Matt. Lord Matt is back. Lord Matt's found us. Lord Matt!"
Tuon exchanged glances with Seleucia. The affection in those voices was unfeigned. That was rare, and often went with a commander who had a slack hand at discipline. But then she expected any army of Toys to be a ragtag affair, full of men who spent their time drinking and gambling. Only these men looked no more ragtag than any regiment that had crossed a mountain range and ridden 700 miles. No one looked unsteady on his feet with drink.
"Mostly we camp during the day and move at night to avoid being seen by the Shonshan," Talmana said to Toy. "Just because we have seen none of those flying beasts does not mean some might not be around. Most of the Shonshan seem to be farther north or farther south, but apparently they have a camp not 30 miles north of here, and rumor says there is one of the creatures there."
"You seem pretty well informed," Toy said, studying the soldiers they passed. He nodded suddenly, as if he had reached a decision. He seemed grim, and could it be resigned?
"I am that, Matt. I brought half the scouts, and I also signed some Altarans who were fighting the Shonshan. Well, most of them seemed to have been stealing horses more than anything else, but some were willing to give that up for a chance to really fight them. I think I know where most of the Shanshan camps are, from the Malvide Narrows south to here. Suddenly a man began to sing in a deep voice, and others joined in, the song spreading rapidly. There's some delight in ale and wine, and some in girls with ankles fine, but my delight, yes, always mine, is to dance with Jack of the Shadows. Every man in the camp was singing now, thousands of voices roaring the song. We'll toss the dice however they fall, and snuggle the girls, be they short or tall, then follow Lord Matt whenever he calls, to dance with Jack of the Shadows. They finished with shouts, laughing and clapping one another on the shoulder. Who under the light was this Jack of the Shadows? Reining in, Toy raised the hand holding his odd spear. That was all, yet silence spread through the soldiers. So he was not soft with discipline. There were a few other reasons for soldiers to be fond of their officers, but the most common seemed unlikely to apply to Toy, of all people. "Let's not let them know we're here until we want them to know," Toy said loudly. He was not orating, just making sure his voice carried. And the men heard, repeating his words over their shoulders to be passed back to men beyond the sound of his voice. "We're a long way from home, but I mean to get us home. So be ready to move, and move fast. The Band of the Red Hand can move faster than anybody else, and we're going to have to prove it." There was no cheering, but plenty of nods. Turning to Talmanis, he said, "Do you have maps?" "The best to be found," Talmanis replied. "The band has its own map maker now. Master Roy Dell already had good maps of everything from the Arith Ocean to the spine of the world, and since we crossed the Damonas, he and his assistants have been making new maps of the country we crossed. They even marked a map of Eastern Altara with what we have learned of the Shanshan. Most of those camps are temporary, though. Soldiers heading somewhere else."
Seleucia shifted in her saddle, and Tuan signed, "Patience," in high imperative form, a command. She kept her face smooth, but inside she was furious. Knowing where soldiers were gave clues to where they were going. There had to be some way to burn that map. That would be as important as laying hands on one of the crossbow cranks.
"I'll want to talk with Master Roy Dell, too," Toy said.
Soldiers came to take the horses, and for a while all seemed confusion and milling about. A gap-toothed fellow took Akain's reins, and Tuan gave him explicit instructions on caring for the mare. He returned her a sour look along with his bow. Commoners in these lands seemed to believe themselves equal to everyone. Seleucia gave the same sort of instructions to the lanky young man who took Rosebud. She thought that an appropriate name for a dresser's horse. The young man stared at Seleucia's chest until she slapped him, hard. He only grinned and led the dun away, rubbing his cheek. Tuan sighed. That was all very well for Seleucia, but for herself, striking a commoner would lower her eyes for months. Soon enough, though, she was settled on a folding stool with Seleucia at her back, and stout Lopin presented them with tin cups full of dark tea, bowing quite properly to Seleucia as well as to her. Not deeply enough, but the balding man did try. Her tea was honeyed to perfection, lightly, but then he had served her often enough to know how she liked it. Activity bustled about them. Talmanis had a brief reunion with gray-haired Nerim, who apparently was his serving man, and happy to be reunited with him. At least the thin man's normally mournful countenance actually flashed a momentary smile. That sort of thing should have been done in private. Lylwyn and Doman allowed Master Charon to lead Ulver off to explore the camp with Juelin and Thera. Tom and Aludra went, too, to stretch their legs, then deliberately took stools close by. Lylwyn even went so far as to stare unblinking at Tuan for a long moment. Seleucia made a low sound, very like a growl, but Tuan ignored the provocation and gestured Mistress Annan to bring her stool over beside her. Eventually the traitors would be punished, and the thief, the property restored to its rightful owners, and the Marath Damani leashed. But those things had to wait on what was more important. Three more officers appeared, young noblemen with that red hand on their dark silk coats, and had their own reunion with Toy, with a great deal of laughing and hitting each other on the shoulder, which they seemed to take as a sign of fondness. She soon had them sorted out. Adorian was the dark, lean man with the serious expression except when smiling. Ryman, the broad-shouldered fellow who smiled a great deal, and Carloman, the tall, slender one. Adorian was clean-shaven, while Ryman and Carloman both had dark beards that were trimmed to points and glistened as if oiled. All three made much over the Aes Sedai, bowing deeply. They even bowed to Bethamin and Sita. Tuan shook her head.
"I've told you often enough it's a different world than you're used to," Mistress Annan murmured. "But you still don't quite believe it, do you?"
"Just because a thing is a certain way," Tuan replied, "doesn't mean it should be that way, even if it has been for a long time."
"Some might say the same of your people, my lady."
"Some might."
Tuan let it rest there, though she usually enjoyed her private conversations with the woman. Mistress Annan argued against leashing Marath Damani, as might be expected, and even against keeping Duco Vale, of all things. Yet they were discussions rather than arguments, and Tuan had made her concede a few points. She had hopes of bringing the woman around eventually. Not today, though. She wanted her mind focused on Toy. Master Roydell appeared, a graying, round-faced man whose bulk strained his dark coat, followed by six fit-appearing younger men, each carrying a long cylindrical leather case.
"I brought all the maps of Altara I have, my lord," he told Talmanis in a musical accent as he bowed. "Did everyone in these lands speak as if racing to get the words out?
Some cover the whole country, they do, some no more than 100 square miles. The best are my own, of course, those I made these past weeks."
"Lord Matt will tell you what he wants to see," Talmanis said. "Shall we leave you to it, Matt?"
But Toy was already telling the map-maker what he wanted, the map marked with the Seanchan camps. In short order it was sorted out from the others in one of the cases and spread on the ground, with Toy squatting on his heels beside it. Master Roydell sent one of his assistants running to fetch him a stool. He would have burst his coat buttons trying to imitate Toy, and likely have fallen over besides. Tuan stared at that map hungrily. How to get her hands on it? Exchanging glances and laughing as if being snubbed were the funniest thing in the world, Talmanis and the other three men strolled toward Tuan. The Aes Sedai gathered around the map on the ground until Toy told them to quit peering over his shoulder. They moved off a little, Bethamin and Sita healing them at a distance, and began talking quietly among themselves, occasionally glancing in his direction. If Toy had been paying any heed to their expressions, especially Jolene's, he might have been worried in spite of the incredible Tarangreal Mistress Annan said he carried.
"We're about here, right?" he said, marking a spot with his finger. Master Roydell murmured that they were.
"So this is the camp where the Rakan supposedly is, the flying beast?" Another murmur of assent. "Good. What kind of camp is it? How many men are there?"
"Reportedly it's a supply camp, my lord, for resupplying patrols."
The young man returned with another folding stool, and the stout man eased himself down with a grunt.
"Supposedly about 100 soldiers, mostly Altaran, and about 200 labourers, but I'm told there can be as many as 500 more soldiers at times."
"A careful man, Master Roydell." Talmanis made one of those odd bows with 1 foot forward, and the other three mirrored him.
"My lady," Talmanis said. "Vanin told me of your circumstances and the promises Lord Matt made. I just want to tell you he keeps his word."
"That he does, my lady," Adorian murmured. "Always."
Tuan motioned him to step aside so she could continue to watch Toy, and he did so with a surprised glance at Toy and another for her. She gave him a stern look. The last thing she wanted was for these men to start imagining things. Not everything had fallen out as it had to yet. There was still a chance this could all go awry.
"Is he a lord or is he not?" she demanded.
"Excuse me," Talmanis said, "but would you say that again? I apologize. I must have dirt in my ears."
She repeated herself carefully, but it still took them a minute to puzzle out what she had said.
"Burn my soul, no," Ryman said finally with a laugh. He stroked his beard. "Except to us. Lord enough for us." "He dislikes nobles, for the most part," Carloman said. "I count it an honor to be among the few he doesn't dislike."
"An honor," Ryman agreed. Adorian contented himself with nodding.
"Soldiers, Master Roydell," Toy said firmly. "Show me where the soldiers are.
and more than any few hundred.
What is he doing? Tuan said, frowning. He can't think to sneak this many men out of Altara, even if he knows where every last soldier is. There are always patrols and sweeps by Rakan.
Again they took their time before answering. Perhaps she should try speaking very fast.
We've seen no patrols in better than 300 miles, and no...
Rakan? No Rakan, Adorian said quietly. He was studying her. Too late to stop his imaginings. Ryman laughed again.
If I know Matt, he's planning us a battle. The Band of the Red Hand rides to battle again. It's been too long, if you ask me.
Seleucia sniffed, and so did Mistress Annan. Tuan had to agree with them.
A battle won't get you out of Altara, she said sharply. In that case, Talmanis said, he's planning us a war.
The other three nodded agreement as if that were the most normal thing under the light. Ryman even laughed. He seemed to think everything was humorous.
3,000? Toy said. You're sure? Sure enough, man. Sure enough will do. Vannin can locate them if they haven't moved too far.
Tuan looked at him, squatting there by the map, moving his fingers over its surface, and suddenly she saw him in a new light. A buffoon? No. A lion stuffed into a horse stall might look like a peculiar joke, but a lion on the high plains was something very different. Toy was loose on the high plains now. She felt a chill. What sort of man had she entangled herself with? After all this time, she realized, she had hardly a clue.